This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents God's Politics by Jim Wallace, read for you by Sam Fried, with an introduction read by the author.
Why can't we talk about religion and politics? These are the two topics you are not supposed to discuss in polite company. Don't break up the dinner party by bringing up either of these subjects. That's the conventional wisdom. Why? Perhaps these topics are too important, too potentially divisive, or raise the issues of core values and ultimate concerns that make us uncomfortable. Sojourners Magazine, where I serve as editor, commits the offense in every single issue of talking about faith, politics, and culture. Yet our subscriber and online lists are growing, especially among a younger generation. I am also on the road a lot, speaking almost every week to very diverse audiences of people. I hear and feel the hunger for a fuller, deeper, and richer conversation about religion in public life, about faith and politics. It's a discussion that we don't always hear in America today. Sometimes the most strident and narrow voices are the loudest, while more progressive, prophetic, and healing faith often gets missed. But the good news is about how all that is changing, really changing. Abraham Lincoln had it right. Our task should not be to invoke religion and the name of God by claiming God's blessing and endorsement for all of our national policies and practices, saying, in effect, that God is on our side. Rather, Lincoln said, we should pray and worry earnestly whether we are on God's side. Those are the two ways that religion has been brought into public life in American history. The first way, God on our side, leads inevitably to triumphalism, self-righteousness, bad theology, and often dangerous foreign policy. The second way, asking if we are on God's side, leads to much healthier things, namely penitence and even repentance, humility, reflection, and even accountability. We need much more of all these, because these are often the missing values of politics. Of course, Martin Luther King Jr. did it best. With his Bible in one hand and Constitution in the other, King persuaded, not just pronounced. He reminded us all of God's purposes for justice, for peace, and for the beloved community. Where those always left out and behind get a front row seat. And he did it, bringing religion into public life in a way that was always welcoming, inclusive, and inviting to all who cared about moral, spiritual, or religious values. Nobody felt left out of the conversation. I try to do that too in this recording. The values of politics are my primary concern in this recording. Of course, God is not partisan. God is not a Republican or a Democrat. When either party tries to politicize God or co-opt religious communities for their political agendas, they make a terrible mistake. The best contribution of religion is precisely not to be ideologically predictable nor loyally partisan. Both parties and the nation must let the prophetic voice of religion be heard. Faith must be free to challenge both right and left from a consistent moral ground. God's politics are therefore never partisan or ideological, but it challenges everything about our politics. God's politics reminds us of the people our politics always neglect, the poor, the vulnerable, the left behind. God's politics challenges narrow national, ethnic, economic, or cultural self-interest, reminding us of a much wider world and the creative human diversity of all those made in the image of the Creator. God's politics reminds us of the creation itself, a rich environment in which we are to be good stewards, not mere users, consumers, and exploiters. And God's politics pleads with us to resolve the inevitable conflicts among us as much as is possible, without the terrible cost and consequences of war. God's politics always reminds us of the ancient prophetic prescription to choose life so that you and your children may live, and challenges all the selective moralities that would choose one set of lives and issues over another. This recording challenges both the right and the left, offering a new vision for faith and politics in America. To do that, we will enter into a new conversation of personal faith and political hope. I hope you will join the discussion. The 2004 election was one of those where, no matter who won, almost half the population was going to feel absolutely crushed, the half that lost in an almost 50-50 electorate. We are now deeply divided, the media say, between red states, Republican, and blue states, Democrat. So how do the people in the red and blue states talk to each other, especially people of faith? I believe there are more common concerns and more potential common ground in both the red and blue states than many think. In the days following November 2nd, the moral values voter, as described, measured, and often misunderstood by the media, became the defining storyline of the election. I welcome this discussion of moral values, and I believe the values debate should be the future of American politics. Of course, the questions are, which values and whose values? How narrowly or widely will values be defined, and how partisan will the discussion be? Will the moral values debate cut both ways in politics, challenging both the political left and the political right, both Republicans and Democrats? Will values be used as wedges to further divide us, or bridges to bring us together, to find common ground by moving to higher ground? We must now ask two questions. Where is the real debate in the moral values conversation? Because there are real differences in America on the values issues. And where can we find common ground? Because there is also much that we share in common and could be built upon. This recording is about both of those questions. As an instance of moral values issues in this election, one side talked about the number of unborn lives lost to abortion every year, while the other pointed to the 100,000 civilian casualties in Iraq. But both are life issues, according to the Pope, for example, who opposes both John Kerry's views on abortion and George Bush's war policy. Some church leaders challenged both candidates on whether just killing terrorists would really end terrorism, and called for a deeper approach. And 200 theologians, many from leading evangelical institutions, warned that a theology of war emanating from the highest circles of government is also seeping into our churches. Clearly, God is not a Republican or a Democrat, and the best contribution of religion is precisely not to be ideologically predictable or loyally partisan, but to maintain the moral independence to critique both the left and the right. My vision, a progressive and prophetic vision of faith and politics, was not running in this election. George Bush and John Kerry's vision were not progressive religion. Neither candidate championed the poor as a moral value, or made the war in Iraq a clearly religious matter, and neither advocated a consistent ethic of human life beyond single-issue voting, or a serious pro-family agenda without being anti-gay. The ways in which both parties' visions are morally and politically incomplete must now be taken up by people of faith. That can best be done by reaching into both the conservative Christian communities who voted for George Bush and the more liberal Christian communities who voted for John Kerry. We've now begun a real debate in this country over what the most important religious issues are in politics, and that discussion will continue well past the 2004 elections. It's time to spark a public conversation in this country over what the moral values in politics should be, and how broadly and deeply they should be defined. Religion doesn't fit neatly into right and left categories. If there were ever candidates running with a strong set of personal moral values and a commitment to social justice and peace, they could build many bridges to the other side. Personal and social responsibility are both at the heart of religion, and the two together could make a very powerful and compelling political vision for the future of our bitterly divided nation. In a deeply polarized country, when half the people do feel crushed, the need for some kind of political healing and reconciliation becomes clear, and that could be one of the most important roles for the religious community. But that shouldn't mean compromise of deeply held convictions on any side. Instead, building on our most deeply held values might be the best way to move forward and create some new political opportunities. In the spirit of America's greatest religious leader, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., the religious community could help a divided nation find common ground by moving to higher ground. This recording explores how people concerned about social change and hungry for spiritual values can actually combine these two quests. Too often, politics and spirituality have been separated, polarized, and even put into competition with one another. We have been buffeted by private spiritualities that have no connection to public life, and a secular politics showing disdain for religion or even spiritual concerns. That leaves spirituality without social consequences and a politics with no soul. And political discourse that is disconnected from moral values quickly degenerates. We will ask how we might change our public life with the values that many of us hold most dear. This recording is about how to connect a genuinely prophetic spirituality to the urgent need for social justice. This is the connection the world is waiting for. Many of us feel that our faith has been stolen, and it's time to take it back. In particular, an enormous public misrepresentation of Christianity has taken place, and because of an almost uniform media misperception, many people around the world now think Christian faith stands for political commitments that are almost the opposite of its true meaning. How did the faith of Jesus come to be known as pro-rich, pro-war, and only pro-American? What has happened here? And how do we get back to a historic, biblical, and genuinely evangelical faith rescued from its contemporary distortions? That rescue operation is even more critical today in the face of a deepening social crisis that cries out for more prophetic religion. Of course, nobody can steal your personal faith. That's between you and God. The problem is in the political arena, where strident voices claim to represent Christians when they clearly don't speak for most of us. It's time to take back our faith in the public square, especially in a time when a more authentic social witness is desperately needed. The religious and political right gets the public meaning of religion mostly wrong, preferring to focus only on sexual and cultural issues while ignoring the weightier matters of justice. And the secular left doesn't seem to get the meaning and promise of faith for politics at all, mistakenly dismissing spirituality as irrelevant to social change. I actually happen to be conservative on issues of personal responsibility, the sacredness of human life, the reality of evil in our world, and the critical importance of individual character, parenting, and strong family values. But the popular presentations of religion in our time, especially in the media, almost completely ignore the biblical vision of social justice, and even worse, dismiss such concerns as merely left-wing. It is indeed time to take back our faith. But take back our faith from whom? To be honest, the confusion comes from many sources, from religious right-wingers who claim to know God's political views on every issue. then ignore the subjects that God seems to care the most about, from pedophile priests and cover-up bishops who destroy lives and shame the church, from television preachers whose extravagant lifestyles and crass fundraising tactics embarrass more Christians than they know, from liberal secularists who want to banish faith from public life and deny spiritual values to the soul of politics, and even from liberal theologians whose cultural conformity and creedal modernity serve to erode the foundations of historic biblical faith, from New Age philosophers who want to make Jesus into a non-threatening spiritual guru, and from politicians who love to say how religious they are, but utterly fail to apply the values of faith to their public leadership and political policies. It's time to reassert and reclaim the gospel faith, especially in our public life. When we do, we discover that faith challenges the powers that be to do justice for the poor, instead of preaching a prosperity gospel and supporting politicians who further enrich the wealthy. We remember that faith hates violence and tries to reduce it and exerts a fundamental presumption against war instead of justifying it in God's name. We see that faith creates community from racial, class, and gender divisions and prefers international community over nationalist religion. And we see that God Bless America is found nowhere in the Bible. And we are reminded that faith regards matters such as the sacredness of life and family bonds as so important that they should never be used as ideological symbols or mere political pawns in partisan warfare. The media like to say, "Oh, then you must be the religious left." No, not at all. And the very question is the problem. Just because a religious right has fashioned itself for political power in one utterly predictable ideological guise does not mean that those who question this political seduction must be their opposite political counterpart. The best public contribution of religion is precisely not to be ideologically predictable or loyal partisan. To always raise the moral issues of human rights, for example, will challenge both left and right-wing governments that put power above principles. Religious action is rooted in a much deeper place than rights, that place being the image of God in every human being. It is precisely because religion takes the problem of evil so seriously that it must always be suspicious of too much concentrated power, politically or economically, either in totalitarian regimes or in huge multinational corporations that now have more wealth and power than many governments. It is indeed our theology of evil that makes us strong proponents of both political and economic democracy, not because people are so good, but because they often are not and need clear safeguards and strong systems of checks and balances to avoid the dangerous accumulations of power and wealth. It's why we doubt the goodness of all superpowers and the righteousness of empires in any era, especially when their claims of inspiration and success invoke theology and the name of God. Given the human tendencies of military and political power for self-delusion and deception, is it any wonder that hardly a religious body in the world regards the ethics of unilateral and preemptive war as just? Religious wisdom suggests that the more overwhelming the military might, the more dangerous its capacity for self and public deception. If evil in this world is deeply human and very real, and religious people believe it is, it just doesn't make spiritual sense to suggest that the evil all lies out there with our adversaries and enemies, and none of it is in here with us, embedded in our own attitudes, behaviors, and policies. Powerful nations dangerously claim to rid the world of evil, but often do enormous harm in their own self-appointed vocation. The loss of religion's prophetic vocation is terribly dangerous for any society. Who will uphold the dignity of economic and political outcasts? Who will question the self-righteousness of nations and their leaders? Who will question the recourse to violence and rush to wars long before any last resort has been unequivocally proven? Who will not allow God's name to be used to simply justify ourselves instead of calling us to accountability? And who will love the people enough to challenge their worst habits, coarser entertainments, and selfish neglects? Prophetic religion always presses the question of the common good. Indeed, the question, whatever became of the common good, must be a constant religious refrain, directed to political partisans whose relentless quest for power and wealth makes them forget the commonwealth again and again. That common good should always be constructed from the deepest wells of our personal and social responsibility, and the absolute insistence to never separate the two. Recovering the faith of the biblical prophets and Jesus is not just about politics. It also shapes the way we live our personal and communal lives. How do we live a faith whose social manifestation is compassion and whose public expression is justice? And how do we raise our children by those values? That may be the most important battle of spiritual formation in our times, as I am personally discovering as a new father. Our religious congregations are not meant to be social organizations that merely reflect the wider culture's values, but dynamic, countercultural communities whose purpose is to reshape both lives and societies. That realization perhaps has the most capacity to transform both religion and politics. We contend today with both religious and secular fundamentalists, neither of whom must have their way. One group would impose the doctrines of a political theocracy on their fellow citizens, while the other would deprive the public square of needed moral and spiritual values, often shaped by faith. In a political and media culture that squeezes everything into only two options of left and right, religious people must refuse the ideological categorization and actually build bridges between people of goodwill in both liberal and conservative camps. We must insist on the deep connections between spirituality and politics while defending the proper boundaries between church and state that protect religious and non-religious minorities and keep us all safe from state-controlled religion. We can demonstrate our commitment to pluralistic democracy and support the rightful separation of church and state without segregating moral and spiritual values from our political life. Neither religious nor secular fundamentalism can save us, but a new spiritual revival that ignites deep social conscience could transform our society. Movements do change history, and the strongest ones are those with a spiritual foundation. Most important of all is the spiritual power of hope, which may be the only thing that can finally overcome our characteristic cynicism. Hope versus cynicism is the key moral and political choice of our time. This recording is about the politics of hope.
Differences in how the campaigns and candidates treated the issue of religion in the 2004 election were very stark, with the Republican convention appearing at times to be a praise service, according to religion writer Amy Sullivan, especially before the primetime television coverage. The Bush campaign's chief political strategist, Karl Rove, made no secret of his intent to reach out aggressively to conservative religious voters. But in doing so, the Bush re-election team seriously overstepped the proper boundaries of church and state by suggesting religious duties that included turning over congregational membership lists to local Republican parties. That offended even members of Bush's own religious base, like Richard Land of the Southern Baptist, who said such partisan activities were inappropriate, and that he was appalled, an honest and honorable criticism. In mailings to churches in some states, the Republican National Committee suggested that liberals, red Democrats, would ban the Bible and accept gay marriage if they were to win. I have never seen such outrageous behavior by a political party in trying to manipulate religion for its own agenda, while so disrespecting the faith of millions of other believers who disagree with the Republican political agenda. What do such tactics say about the Republicans' respect for the black churches when the African-American vote was again almost 90% for the Democrats? Is something wrong with their faith? Do black churches ban the Bible? The Republicans virtually claim to own religion, and the Democrats still don't seem to know how to take back the faith. If the Republicans overstepped in their religious outreach, the Democrats understepped in the effort to be more religion-friendly than they have in the recent past. Listening more carefully to religious voices both inside and outside the Kerry campaign would have provided more strategic help and public capacity in speaking directly to the important issues of religion and politics and seeking to broaden their definition in this election campaign. To be fair, the Democrats, both at their convention and in their campaign, did try to offer a new open door to the religious community in important ways, and Kerry began to talk about how his own faith influenced his values. But Kerry could have done much more to speak to religious audiences, talk to the religious press, and redefine the religious issues at stake in this campaign by moving away from just abortion and the Eucharist, and including poverty and war. The Democrats should be much more willing to use moral and religious language in defense of economic fairness and justice. But they shouldn't make the same mistake the Republicans have made in trying to co-opt religious leaders and communities for their political agenda. Nor should they suggest that religious people have an exclusive hold on the issue of morality, thus disrespecting millions of Americans who have deep moral concerns about the direction of their country but no religious affiliation. The issue here is not religiosity per se, but rather the moral compass, derived very often from religious principles and beliefs that a political leader or party brings to public life. There were two issues in the 2004 election that most tugged at my heart, worry my Christian conscience, and compel me to faithful citizenship and discipleship. The first is poverty. The second is war. As the Bush administration began, I joined a small group of religious leaders to meet with the president-elect in Austin, Texas. To his credit, George W. Bush invited both those who had voted for him and against him. We encouraged him to commit himself to a concrete and measurable goal in the battle against poverty, such as cutting child poverty by half in 10 years, as the British Labour government under Tony Blair had pledged. I thought a Republican president, in the name of compassionate conservatism, could make new progress on the critical issue of poverty, much like Nixon's going to China. I told him he should surprise everybody with an aggressive anti-poverty agenda. I supported the president's faith-based initiative, much to the chagrin of Democratic friends, but from the beginning of the Bush presidency, many of us have had a very consistent message. Significant resources must be committed to serious poverty reduction, not just in a faith-based initiative, but especially in budget decisions, tax policies, and spending priorities. 2 years later, a statement organized by Call to Renewal, which is a broad coalition of churches and faith-based leaders united to overcome poverty, and signed by 34 Christian leaders across the theological and political spectrum, concluded, sadly, that the president had failed the test of resources and priorities, which made our continuing support for his faith-based initiative increasingly untenable. Without the resources and policies to seriously reduce poverty, the faith-based initiative became words without backing, faith without works. A faith-based initiative could have been done differently, with the resources and policies to back it up, but this one has turned out to be a big disappointment. with policy failures such as the denial of child tax credits to low-income families that would have brought the biblical prophets to the White House lawn. Other priorities were just more important to the Bush administration than poverty reduction. Tax cuts that mostly benefited the wealthy were more important. The war in Iraq was more important. And homeland security was more important. All without the key recognition of how poverty, despair, family instability, and social disintegration undermine our national security. A budget based on a windfall of benefits for the wealthy and harsh cuts for poor families and children is an unbiblical budget. The good people who have run the White House faith-based office were clearly not the ones making policy and budget decisions for the Bush administration. One result of the lack of White House leadership has been the steady rise in the number of people, families, and children living in poverty in each of the last 3 years, according to the 2003 U.S. Census report. And that is a religious issue. In his speech to the 2004 Republican Convention, the president spoke about many important issues: education reform and opportunity, health care security, job training, support for low-income families and neighborhoods. There were new and promising directions in his notion of an ownership society, which focuses on things such as tax credits, educational equality, and home ownership for lower-income families as an alternative to relying on only entitlement programs. In an August 2004 article in the New York Times Magazine, conservative writer David Brooks laid out a vision for progressive republicanism that has a clear role for the positive action of government to make work actually work for low-income families, with a whole range of wage supplements and wealth creation for poor working families. There were signs of such a vision in the Bush speech, but the president failed to deal with how his central domestic priority, making permanent his tax cuts that most benefit the wealthy, will simply not allow such positive government initiatives because of a lack of resources. The Brooks vision will never be possible if Republicans stick to their characteristic anti-government ideology that is so reluctant to spend money to reduce poverty. George W. Bush has not changed that mentality, but rather submitted to it. Until it changes, the poor will continue to suffer. On the issue of the war in Iraq, Congress voted to give the president the authority to go to war, and Bush misused and abused that authority in why, when, and how he took America to war. Now we are in a real mess, and George W. Bush should not be allowed to get away with the deceptions, incompetence, and consequences of this awful war. The war in Iraq was wrong from the start. A Christian president ignored the conviction of the vast majority of the world's Christians that the war in Iraq was wrong and that there is a better way, a more effective and morally consistent way to fight terrorism. Bush's war in Iraq is the beginning of a long-term strategy of preemptive war and mostly unilateral American foreign policy that is both mistaken and terribly dangerous for the future. My older son is 6 years old, and my other son is almost two. If America's present course continues, they will be facing endless war in their lives, perhaps even still in Iraq, and who knows where else. Many Americans believe there is a better way, including many people of faith. I had lunch one day with the head of a major nonprofit housing provider for the poor, who put the question to me again, saying, "I am a reader of the New Testament, and I just don't understand how a right-wing economic agenda can be squared with the clear teachings of Jesus on wealth and poverty in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John." That's the problem with the economic and political agenda of the religious right. Most people know what Jesus said about these things, whether they are Christians or not. And the conformity of many conservative evangelical leaders to the political right and its agenda that favors the wealthy over the poor and middle class just doesn't make any sense to them. They know that Jesus was not pro-rich, pro-war, and only pro-American. So why are so many conservative evangelicals oblivious to the teachings of Jesus, they wonder? Why do family values groups support the Republican right-wing economic agenda when it hurts so many low-income families? And how can some even claim that God is pro-war? Most people just don't get it, because they know that Jesus was on the side of the poor and the cause of peace. The politics of Jesus is a problem for the religious right. Jesus said, "Blessed are the poor," and opened up his own ministry by proclaiming, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor," which was a direct biblical reference to the Jubilee year in the Hebrew Scriptures, where, periodically, the debts of the poor were canceled, slaves were set free, and land was redistributed for the sake of equity. People such as U2's lead singer Bono see the contemporary relevance of such scripture for issues such as global poverty and the HIV/AIDS pandemic in Africa, and so do many of his young fans. So why don't others see it? In Matthew's 25th chapter, Jesus speaks of the hungry, the homeless, the stranger, prisoners, and the sick, and promises he will challenge all his followers on the judgment day with these words, "As you have done to the least of these, you have done to me." James Forbes, the pastor of Riverside Church in New York City, concludes from that text that nobody gets to heaven without a letter of reference from the poor. How many of America's most famous television preachers could produce the letter? In a world of violence and war, the words of Jesus, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God," are not only challenging, they are daunting. The hardest saying of Jesus, and perhaps the most controversial in our post-September 11th world, must be, "Love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you." Let's be honest. How many churches in the United States have heard sermons preached from either of these Jesus texts in the years since America was viciously attacked on that world-changing morning of September 11th, 2001? Shouldn't we at least have a debate about what the words of Jesus mean in the new world of terrorist threats and preemptive wars? Jesus knows no national boundaries or national preferences. The body of Christ is an international one, and the allegiance of Christians to the church must always supersede their national identities. The words of Jesus stand as a virtual roadblock to any nation's pretension to rationalize and sanctify the preference for war. Jesus's instruction to be peacemakers leads either to nonviolent alternatives to war or, at least, a rigorous application of the church principles of just war. Christ commands us to not only see the splinter in our adversary's eye, but also the beams in our own, which often obstruct our own vision. To name the face of evil in the brutality of terrorist attacks is good theology, but to say that they are evil and we are good is bad theology that can lead to dangerous foreign policy. Self-reflection should provide no excuses for terrorist violence, but it is crucial to defeating the terrorists' agenda. Christ instructs us to love our enemies, which does not mean a submission to their hostile agendas or domination, but it does mean treating them as human beings, also created in the image of God, and respecting their human rights as adversaries and even as prisoners. And Christ calls us to confession and humility, which does not allow us to say that if persons and nations are not in support of all of our policies, they must be with the evildoers. The words of Jesus are either authoritative for Christians or they are not, and they are not set aside by the very real threats of terrorism. They do not easily lend themselves to the missions of nation-states that would usurp the prerogatives of God. The threat of terrorism does not overturn Christian ethics. War, of course, is also a deeply theological matter. the near-unanimous opinion of religious leaders worldwide that the Iraq War failed to fit just war criteria is an issue for many Christians, especially as the warnings from religious leaders have proved prophetically and tragically accurate. The plagues of war, as the Pope has referred to the continuing problems in Iraq, are in part a consequence of a Christian president simply not listening to the counsel of religious leaders who tried to speak to the White House. What has happened to the consistent ethic of life suggested by Catholic social teaching, which speaks against abortion, capital punishment, poverty, war, and a range of human rights abuses too often selectively respected by pro-life advocates? The religious right's grip on public debates about values has been driven in part by a media that continues to give airtime to the loudest religious voices, rather than the most representative, leaving millions of Christians and other people of faith without a say in the values debate. But this is starting to change, as progressive and prophetic faith voices are speaking out with a confidence and moral urgency not seen for 25 years. Mobilized by human suffering in many places, groups motivated by religious social conscience, including many evangelicals not defined by the religious right, have hit a new stride in efforts to combat poverty, destructive wars, human rights violations, pandemics like HIV/AIDS, and genocide in places like Sudan. In politics, the best interest of the country is served when the prophetic voice of religion is heard, challenging both right and left from consistent moral ground. The evangelical Christians of the 19th century combine revivalism with social reform and help lead movements for abolition and women's suffrage, not to mention the faith-based movement that directly preceded the rise of the religious right, namely the American Civil Rights Movement led by the black churches. The truth is that most of the important movements for social change in America have been fueled by religion, progressive religion. The stark moral challenges of our time have once again begun to awaken this prophetic tradition. As the religious right loses influence, nothing could be better for the health of both church and society than a return of the moral center that anchors our nation in a common humanity. If you listen, these voices can be heard rising again. It was one of those warm spring days in the nation's capital when the fresh promise of new possibilities seems, just for a moment, to defy the entrenched ways of Washington. Surrounded by the impressive vista of monuments and museums on the Mall, I stood behind a rough lectern on a makeshift stage, looking into the eyes of 1,000 low-income people, mostly single mothers who had been on welfare. My job was to speak, and my topic was hope. In a city where the currency is power, these poor Americans seemed a bit out of place. Not used to having much clout in their political system, you could tell they were feeling the energy that comes from just being together. They had come on buses from urban and rural communities to lobby the Congress for a new welfare reform bill, one that would effectively help people like themselves escape poverty and move to self-sufficiency. I urged the moms on the Mall not to waste any valuable time while they were in Washington. I wanted them to be able to quickly recognize the members of Congress whom they had come to see. "They're the ones," I told them, "who walk around town with their fingers held high in the air, having just licked them and put them up to see which way the wind is blowing. It's quite a sight. Men and women walking all around the Capitol grounds with their wet index fingers pointed at the sky. The political leaders are really very good at figuring out the direction of the wind and are quite used to quickly moving in that direction. It's not a matter of malice for most of them. I've met quite a few politicians, and in fact many came to Washington because they truly wanted to do the right thing. But after a while, they get entrenched in Washington's ways, and change seems ever more distant. Power and wealth are the real governors here, and people adjust to those realities. Many of us believe that by replacing one wet-fingered politician with another, we can change our society. But it never really works, and when it doesn't, we get disillusioned. We then get tempted to just grumble, withdraw, or give up altogether on ever changing anything. But that's where we make our mistake. The great practitioners of real social change, like Martin Luther King Jr. and Mahatma Gandhi, understood something very important. They knew that you don't change a society by merely replacing one wet-fingered politician with another. You change a society by changing the wind. Change the wind. Transform the debate. Recast the discussion. Alter the context in which political decisions are being made, and you will change the outcomes. Move the conversation around a crucial issue to a whole new place, and you will open up possibilities for change never dreamed of before. And you will be surprised at how fast the politicians adjust to the change in the wind. I gave my audience an historical example. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had just won the Nobel Peace Prize and was ready to come home from Norway. The Freedom Movement had achieved a great victory in securing the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and King was honored as the newest Nobel laureate. But the civil rights leader decided to stop by Washington, D.C., even before heading back home to Atlanta, because he needed to meet with the President of the United States, Lyndon Baines Johnson. King told Johnson that the next step on the road to freedom was a Voting Rights Act, without which black Americans in the South would never be able to really change their communities. But the nation's master of realpolitik told America's moral leader that he couldn't deliver a Voting Rights Act. Johnson said he had cashed in all his chits with the Southern senators to get the civil rights law passed, and that he had no political capital left. It would be 5 or 10 years, the president told King, before a Voting Rights Act would be politically possible. But we can't wait that long, said King. Without voting rights, civil rights couldn't be fully realized. I'm sorry, Johnson reportedly told King, but a voting rights law just wasn't politically realistic. They would have to wait. But Martin Luther King Jr. was not one to simply complain, withdraw, or give up. Instead, King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference began organizing in a sleepy little town nobody had ever heard of called Selma, Alabama. On one fateful day, King and the SCLC leaders marched right across the Edmund Pettus Bridge alongside the people of Selma to face the notorious Sheriff Jim Clark and his virtual army of angry white police. On what would be called Bloody Sunday, a young man, and now congressman from Atlanta, named John Lewis, was beaten almost to death, and many others were injured or jailed. Just days later, in response to that brutal event, hundreds of clergy from all across the nation and from every denomination came to Selma and joined in the Selma to Montgomery march. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel came down from New York to march beside the black Baptist minister Martin Luther King Jr., as did more ministers from around the country than had ever before come out to support the civil rights struggle, which for them had also become a religious one. The whole nation was watching. The eyes of America were focused on Selma, as they had been on Birmingham before the civil rights law was passed. And after the historic Selma to Montgomery March for Freedom, it took only 5 months, not 5 years or 10, to pass a new Voting Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. King had changed the wind. I think that's what people of faith and conscience are supposed to be, wind changers. People motivated by spiritual values that give them a real vision for change are not like those with their fingers up in the air. They already know the direction to head in, and they lead by example. Their commitments, skills, sacrifices, creativity, and ultimately moral authority are what make all the difference and change the wind. They also have the capacity to gather people around the vision, and in terms that places like Washington can understand. They demonstrate that they have a critical constituency. But what they really demonstrate is a fundamental principle, that history is most changed by social movements with a spiritual foundation. Look at the social movements that have made the most difference for social justice, and that is what you find. To change the wind, you have to know what direction you want it to move in, and that is about vision. Today, both religion and politics have a vision problem, and changing that will be the substance of this recording. An ancient biblical proverb well sums up our political life at the beginning of the 21st century. Without a vision, the people perish. The writer of this scripture understood that when our public life falters or fails, it is usually for a lack of vision. In our own contemporary society, the vision problem is identified in public opinion polls year after year as the central reason why American politics seems to lack both principle and purpose, and why our political discourse produces lots of blame but not many solutions. Without real solutions to pressing and increasingly urgent social problems, the people are indeed perishing, both literally and spiritually. We all suffer when there is no vision, no guiding moral compass that steers our public life. We become bereft of meaning and purpose in our social relationships. We lose all sense of the common good or our shared humanity. And the bonds of society themselves become so frayed that each individual feels forced to just fend for themselves. The poorest and weakest among us, who are the least able to do that, pay the greatest price. But we are all diminished when our social life is reduced to the survival of the fittest. Another reading of the Proverbs text makes an even deeper point. The New Revised Standard Version of the Bible translates this famous text as, "When there is no prophecy, the people cast off restraint." Perhaps that prophetic insight explains why a lack of vision in a society contributes directly to social unrest, lawlessness, violence, and chaos. It may not just be poverty that leads to social breakdown, but also the absence of any compelling and credible vision articulated by public leaders and accepted by the people that serves to hold a society together. We have seen societies where many people are still poor. The New South Africa, for example, where between 45% and 55% of the population and between 57% and 75% of children are living in poverty. But a widely shared trust in the vision for the future, articulated by leaders like Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu, enables people to make common sacrifices toward clear goals and even to be patient in the sufferings of the moment. We have also witnessed societies with less suffering but much more discontent, where trust has been broken or expectations raised only to be dashed. Vision, therefore, is vitally important, and vision leads directly to values. What is politics for? This is the critical question seldom asked. What is the purpose of our public life, its meaning, its shaping and guiding principles? Where do we want to go and why? What do we want to achieve? And most important, what is a good society? Those are all questions about values, and values will be the most important political question of the 21st century. Again, the values problem has emerged as a deeply felt public concern in survey after survey of political attitudes over the last few decades. Special interests, political ideology, and the naked quest for power continue to control our public discourse and political decision-making. But the public alienation caused by the absence of core moral values in our political life seems to grow each year. Issues such as the strength of family life, the meaning of work, the health of neighborhoods, the well-being of children, and the shame of child poverty, the moral tone of entertainment, the truth-telling of public officials, the quality and moral content of education, the equity of health care, the stewardship of the environment, and the consistency of foreign policy with expressed national values are all deeply held moral concerns at the heart of contemporary political issues. But many politicians still don't speak the language of ethics and values that could strike responsive chords among many people hungry for a moral political discourse. For example, the sacred value of human life is deeply shared by many people, even of diverse political persuasions, yet seldom consistently applied across a wide spectrum of political issues. The lack of vision in public life and the emptying out of values that visionless leadership creates lead to a politics of complaint. In reaction to politics without values, people begin to complain, and there is much to complain about. Moral cohesion unravels, social values crumble, public policies lose their connection to the common good, families lose stability, neighborhoods lose community, leadership loses integrity, poor families and children begin losing everything, and complaint becomes our dominant political discourse. I believe the place to look for a new vision is a very old place, the humble messengers of ancient days who talked about the politics of God. Whether you are religious or not, that isn't the point really, you'll be drawn to the prophets if you think that values should be the center of politics. Do you long for a politics as if values mattered? This recording is about a new vision for the common good that could inspire us all to lives of service and to a whole new set of public, read, political, priorities. The vision we will put forward in this recording for our contemporary society is simply the content of what the Old Testament prophets, Jesus, and the New Testament writers had to say about our public commitments, our common life,